It is Sunday, August 11th, 2013, and this is episode 30 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and as always, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and don't represent those of my employer. All right, so tonight is a little different, and I think last time I mentioned we were going to be having a co-host from now on. And so with me tonight is an old friend of mine, and I mean old in every sense of the word, right? I think I first met him over 20 years ago. So Andy Callett, known as Lurg on the Twitters. Say hi, Andy.
Hey, Jerry. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. I'm very honored to join you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And I'll echo, any of my comments are mine and mine alone, do not represent any of my employers, past, present, or future.
That's probably a good thing.
So I will tell you that there is a bit of a betting pool going on to see how long I last. Right now, the safe money's on about 3 episodes before you kick me off with something along the lines of, I want to spend more time with my family or something like that. So we'll see how it goes.
I love it. We'll see. All right. So, in keeping with the previous history of the podcast, the idea here continues to be to talk about stories that are relevant to defenders. And so I've picked a couple of stories that we're going to talk about tonight. And, you know, the advantage of having somebody else on the podcast is, you know, we can kind of kick the ideas back and forth and, you know, get different perspectives on it. So the first story I have tonight has to do with a company called Efficient Services Escrow Group. And so this is a escrow service company in California. And Brian Krebs wrote a pretty good post about this. They were compromised, and a couple of pretty significant financial transfers were made from their bank account and sent to Russia and China. So totaling about $1.5 million. It wasn't an incredibly large company. I think they had 9 employees. But what's interesting to me is that in the ensuing investigation and some back and forth with the bank and some government regulators, it came to pass that the controller's PC had a remote access Trojan on it. And that apparently enabled the money to be transferred. And so now there's kind of a spat with the bank because, you know, the owners of the company and the regulators who are now trying to reclaim money are basically saying, hey, you know what? You should have noticed that all this money was leaving out the back door and going to China. And the bank is saying, hey, you know what? It was your ID that got compromised, you know? So anyway, to me, this just continues to highlight the theme that, you know, if you're performing sensitive functions on a PC, you really have to treat it differently. So, Mr. Callett.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, one thing I read in this article, too, that was kind of crazy is that when all this went down, the state of California stepped in and gave them 3 days to recover some of the $1.1 million of the second transfer. And when they couldn't get it done in 3 days, the state shut them down. So they had 9 employees. They had to let go. All loss of income. Just, you know, devastating to the organization. And to me, you know, I was thinking about this. a couple things. One, you know, you got to wonder if there's something like mint.com so you can monitor your, you know, banking accounts for a commercial. I'm kind of joking there, but there really isn't any of the consumer protections around the commercial side of this stuff. And, you know, I would think it would behoove organizations like this to really kind of war game out what are worst case scenarios, right? What happens if we lose all the money in our escrow accounts? How are we going to deal with that? And I don't think these guys ever conceived of this as a possibility, and it put them out of business. And it you know, they'll probably eventually get their money back. They mentioned that they're trying to go to insurance, but they really needed some sort of backup plan here. Agree with you as well that their main box that they're accessing this on, you know, they need to have some better controls over. I mean, this isn't like you're logging into Amazon to buy some shoes. I don't know. I don't want to blame the victim here because they clearly were victimized, but they, you know, in this world, we really have to think about what happens if I do and not be in crisis mode as it happens.
Yeah. The thing that strikes me is that you get a lot of these smaller companies that basically say, you know what, I'm too small to be targeted. And, you know, it lulls people into a false sense of security. And, you know, you don't often take the time to understand what you ought to be doing and what protections you ought to be putting in place. And so I think this is just a really good example of how that can go really wrong, particularly for a small group, which they probably didn't have a big fancy security infrastructure. They probably had no idea it was going on. They were probably lucky to have antivirus on one of their 9 PCs.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, small businesses have in their mindset, you know, they need an accountant, they need a lawyer, even if they're part-time, even if they spend for a couple hours a month to consult. You know, I really look at us as security practitioners, defenders, very akin to lawyers, right? We're here to advise on risk, we're here to advise on ways to mitigate that risk, how much it's going to cost, and then it's up to the organization to decide if they want to do that or not. But these guys probably were completely unaware. And of course, we're, you know, kind of making some assumptions here, but, you know, this put them out of business, right? Bad guys from overseas put them completely out of business. And, you know, was it 13 people are without jobs? Clearly, it doesn't matter how small you are. In this case, they're handling money. They had money in the bank account. They were relying on that money to do their job. That really was, you know, kind of their way of doing work. And especially when regulators can shut you down so easily like this, you know, it behooves companies to understand what their risks are and, you know, what their threats are to their operation and their business. And even if that is just, you know, bringing in some fee-only guy for, you know, just a day, just to look at their enterprise and take a look and say, hey, you know, have you thought about if X, Y, and Z happens? You know, kind of like disaster recovery. What happens if you lose this box? What happens if you lose this office? How are you going to continue your operation? What happens if you lose your bank account? What if your bank account suddenly just has a glitch and is gone? You know, I just don't know that these guys think the way that we think because we're twisted and broken and we think in very, you know, cynical ways. And I think companies need to be slightly more cynical about this stuff to have a game plan or at least understand it and decide, hey, the risk is too minuscule. The cost is too high to mitigate it. Let's just take the risk and roll the dice.
Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly, we've both been with some really small companies. And one thing I've observed is the smaller the company, the bigger the risk they're willing to float, right?
Yep.
You know, they, from every angle, right? Charging things on credit cards, not necessarily being fully truthful with what their products can do. And well, you know, that sort of thing, right?
So yeah, the
redundant knock in Denver, right?
you mean the router on the desk?
That one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And you know, we're kind of making a bit of an inside joke here that the listeners won't get, but Jerry and I have been together on many, many projects over many companies and in many different you know, situations. And over time, we'll tell some of those stories that can be told. But we definitely both worked for a company that stretched the truth a bit on the resiliency of our operation. Fortunately, we never got called out on it. But you know, I think, you know, it's funny because even in business operations, I saw this the other day. Where one sales guy wanted to do something that was outside the box of the organization that he was working for. And, you know, small organizations, he would argue, would just jump in there and figure out how to do it. And a larger, mature operation has some more you know, rigor around that and says, no, this is not our core competency. And I think that's very much the case as well when you talk about small business and all sense of risk.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes that's what you got to do to grow the company. But look what happened. So how do you mitigate against this? I mean, can you have insurance that can pay out fast enough? Can you transfer this risk off? And, you know, that's something I'd like to, you know, look into. But, I really do think these guys got to realize that banks are not your friend when this happens. And maybe that means you spread your money out to multiple banks. Maybe that you've just got a plan for something bad like this happening and have a backup plan.
Yeah, especially in the case of this company, the industry they were in, apparently they had a 24-hour window to report. And then once they reported, they had a 3-day window to resolve the problem. And you can't get a bank to do a damn thing. And in that amount of time, at least. And, you know, I don't think you could reasonably think that you could get an insurance company to do anything in that amount of time either.
Yeah, especially with the regulator, you know, being able to shut them down within 3 days. That's right. Really scary. And I think that's probably specific to their sort of escrow, you know, business that they're running. But yeah, all the more reason that, you know, yeah, just filing the claim with your insurance company on a $1.1 million loss is not something they're going to resolve in 3 days.
Exactly.
So it's a shame for those guys. But, you know, hopefully their loss will be something the rest of us can learn from.
Absolutely. That's the idea. All right, let's move on to the next story. And so this is something that's somewhat interesting to me. And I think I've talked about this a few times before. And this is the cybersecurity framework that the President of the United States issued in an executive order to create a couple months ago. And it's in the process of being created. I get to kind of watch that from the sidelines as it's happening, have a tiny little bit of input. And, you know, my assessment is it's going to be an amalgamation of existing frameworks and standards and security principles. And the idea is that we in the U.S. want our critical infrastructure players to abide by some best practices. And it's kind of an interesting thing because we're basically saying, you know, tell us what you want to comply to, and, you know, we'll hold you accountable to it. But so the story here is that I don't know what his position is, right? Somebody working for the president published a list of incentives for companies to comply with this framework. And again, this framework is completely voluntary. There isn't any teeth. There's no regulation, and then there's not a planned regulation for people or organizations to comply with this. So the government's trying to get creative. And so they've come up with a number of ideas. And I thought some of these were pretty interesting. And they kind of tie a thread through some of the stories that we're talking about. So I'll just kind of go through their ideas, right? The first one is cybersecurity insurance. So we talked about that a little bit on the past story. But what they're talking about here is urging the insurance industry to formalize a cybersecurity insurance program, right? And so that has some interesting side effects. And that's actually going to be the topic of the next story, so I'll hold that for now. The next benefit is grants. So the government may grant you some money to do something in the means of complying with this framework. Process preference is the next one. So, you know, the government has some incident response capability. And so what they're saying is that if you comply with the framework, you know, you'll get preferential treatment. You'll get priority. You'll be above somebody who's not. Certainly, you know, what they're saying is that the most critical will be at the top no matter what. But, you know, otherwise, this is going to be a secondary determinant. Liability limitation. This is where it starts to get really interesting for me. So they're saying if you as an organization will comply with this framework, you know, we're going to propose some legislation that will limit your liability in the event that something bad goes wrong. So if you, you know, comply with this regulation or this framework and you get hacked or something bad happens, the government's got your back. We're going to limit how much, you know, fines or civil damages you can get. Streamlining regulations is next. I think they always throw this one out there. So, you know, how can we reduce the red tape around your operations? Public recognition. So I don't know if that means the president's going to wear a jacket with, you know, little badges of all the companies that comply with the framework. I don't know, you know. Maybe they're going to have the baseball hats like the NASCAR, you know, where they're interviewing the NASCAR racers and there's somebody behind the president changing his hat every couple minutes.
I was thinking like Boy Scout patches. You could sew on your shirt.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be visible, right? It's public recognition.
That's right.
Rate recovery for price-regulated industries. So a lot of the critical infrastructure companies are things like power companies and water companies, and their prices are dictated to them, right? So the governments, the state governments usually limit what you can charge per kilowatt hour, per 1,000 gallons or whatever. So what they're saying here is that if you comply with this, you know, we're going to pressure state governments to allow you, the company, to pass that cost onto your end customer, despite whatever state requirements there are. And then the last one, cybersecurity research, you know, that's probably a boondoggle.
Well, that one's also interesting too, because they're talking about, you know, the agencies involved will recommend areas where commercial solutions exist that help mitigate some risk. So that sounds very quickly like, hey, how do I get my, you know, ABC security company product onto that list? Who do I need to bribe in Congress, right? So that could be interesting.
Oh, yeah. I tell you, you know, I haven't been deeply involved in this, but I've got to believe that a lot of the security players were just squealing at the opportunity to use this framework as a way to force companies to buy their stuff. I mean, remember back in the days of Sarbanes-Oxley, I remember companies, you know, vendors like Cisco and others coming to us saying, hey, you know what? We've got the only Sarbanes-Oxley compliant wireless access point.
That's awesome. You know, I always thought Sarbanes-Oxley was so vague. It was a jobs program for consultants anyway. So that's good on Cisco. That's excellent marketing. That's very helpful. While you were presenting the story, I had a moment to look up who this guy is who wrote this. And you might be interested to know that his name is Michael Daniel. He's the special assistant to the president and cybersecurity coordinator. So he's a special assistant, and he leads the interagency development of national cybersecurity strategy and policy, and he oversees agencies' implementation of those policies. That's some buzzword bingo for you there. So, you know, it's interesting. But I like that it's voluntary. I think that's helpful. I'm not a fan of the government mandating these things. But, you know, I not to be a cynic, but you guys will find out that I kind of am. This will probably end up a bit like the PCI thing, right? It's going to be a checkbox. It's going to have some specific criteria, and you could be completely compliant and still completely insecure. You know, but this is a natural reaction. We have to do something. We have to set a baseline. But one of the things that I always say is that all security is like real estate. It's all local. It all depends on what's going on in your situation, in your environment. And just mandating, you know, broad categories of things. And we don't know what's in these recommendations yet. You know, again, it's not a terrible thing to do. It's just not a panacea in any sense of the imagination. And we'll see. You know, the other thing that was interesting is they're really dangling some stuff out here that I thought interesting, including liability limitation that you mentioned. One of the things they call it specifically is creation of a federal legal privilege that preempts state disclosure requirements.
Yes.
And in some ways, you know, that's got to that starts to get interesting when you start, you know, start messing with all these different states and all their different disclosure laws. And, you know, people can start hiding behind this stuff saying, hey, you know, we followed XYZ policy and, you know, so we don't need to disclose. We shall see.
Part of what's going to be interesting there is how the box is drawn around who's critical.
Right. And you know, I know we're not necessarily supposed to talk politics much, but if there's one thing I've seen the government do is continue to grow and continue to encroach. So, you know, let's say everybody agrees that, you know, power and gas and water is critical. Well, when do ISPs become critical? When do banks become critical?
Yep.
You know, when do, I don't know, phone companies become critical? You name it. You can make an argument for it if you've got an axe to grind. And we'll see. We'll see where this goes. It is interesting. But, you know, right now it's voluntary. Who knows how long it will be?
Yeah, I'm with you there. We'll see. More to come there. The draft of the framework is due out in October. And I think the final one is due at some time around the end of the first quarter.
So, and I'm sure it will be riveting reading. I have no doubt. It will be a page turner.
Oh, so cynical.
I wait for it like I wait for the next R.R. Martin book. I want to know what happens.
Wow. All right.
I'm not going to make three episodes, am I? I might not make one.
I'm going to have to re-record this after you're gone. All right. Next story, this comes from Naked Security. You know, I got to tell you, I've always been a little concerned when I send Naked Security links to my coworkers. You know, I have to wonder if the HR filter on the email is lighting up.
Your file's getting a little bigger each time.
Yes. And it's pretty big already. All right. So, again, Naked Security, which is a Sophos blog. The title is, Will Insurance Firms Be the Big Winners in the Struggle for Cybersecurity? And this kind of ties into the last two stories. And the impetus for this story was actually that blog post we just talked about. And for me, personally, this is a little interesting because, you know, I've mentioned a couple of times, I've started to really get interested in the quantitative aspects of security and risk management. And, you know, one of the areas that's been really soft in the area of security is a quantitative view, right? And so many other areas have some really very structured science around it. And security is almost like an art form, right? You know, as far as the threats we address, you know, there's not a lot of science that goes behind it. It's the things that we think are important are generally what we go after. And a lot of times we're right because we're tied into the industry, right? But if you look at this from the lens of an actuary, right, this stuff has been done for a long time in many other areas. And so I think the big opportunity here is to drive a lot more kind of actuarial rigor around security. And the other thing that I find really interesting is that if the whole idea of secure or cybersecurity insurance takes off, you know, what are the insurance providers going to do to their customers? I mean, they're not going to just send them a form and say, you know, do you have passwords longer than 8 characters and do you have a firewall? And, you know, they're going to be asking really thorough questions. And I suspect, you know, your premiums are going to be directly tied to the quality of your controls.
Well, what they'll have is a series of consultants who go out there doing, you know, very equivalent to PCI QSAs, right? Going to check your you know, rigor around whatever it is the insurance industry has established as best practices, and ultimately based on that, you know, what your premiums are. And I agree that this is something that, you know, if we can insure against other massive risk and transferring that liability, whether it be theft, whether it be a fire, whether it be, you know, business continuity insurance, there's no reason that we can't figure this out. Like, let's take a look back at that escrow company that went out of business, right? And it's easy, without having to understand all the technology, I would say it's easier to understand what is the business risk and what is the cost of that risk without having to understand how somebody did it. But, you know, if you take it, you know, almost from a DR perspective, right? This bad thing happens. How does that affect our company? This bad thing happens. How does that affect our company? And how can we mitigate that financially with insurance? You know, is one way I think you can look at this. And I do think there's a market here, but I think I just think that there's a lot of fear and uncertainty and doubt around how you do this, right? You know, you could have a firewall and have a best firewall on the planet, but if you configure it poorly, you're really insecure. You know, it's a lot easier to get your head around these physical aspects of some of the insurance things. You know, if we're talking about fire insurance, do you have a sprinkler? Does it work? Yes or no? Right? That might affect your premiums. So, this is something we've kicked around for a long time. I remember back in the day, one company was offering cyber security insurance if you use their managed services. That never really went anywhere, but, you know, it's a bit of a gimmick there. But I do think companies are going to have to get serious about this. They're going to have to transfer this risk. I just don't know that many companies know how yet, but I do think this is going to be an industry for sure.
Definitely. Now, I think there's two important distinctions from PCI. It is very similar in a lot of ways, but PCI really has nothing to lose. I mean, one interesting thing about PCI is if any of their covered entities gets compromised, what is the first thing the PCI council says, right? Oh, you know, because by virtue of you being compromised, you are not PCI compliant.
Right.
You know, and so if you ask them, they'll say no one who's PCI compliant has ever been hacked.
Yeah, and
which is crap.
Yeah,
but if you are an insurance company, right, you have a lot more to lose. They're kind of like the casino, mm-hmm. right? They're going to come out ahead.
Absolutely. They're in the business to make money, right? And they're in the business of spreading that financial risk out, right? So it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. They need enough companies buying into it to spread that risk out so that when they do pay out, they can absorb it with the other premiums. But they really need to understand the risk.
That's the key. That's the key. And that's where I think we're going to see a lot of benefit coming up from this, you know, is that we're going to see a lot more quantification and, you know, driving some more rigor into this and understanding from a business perspective, what is the risk of different IT decisions, where I don't think we have a good handle on that right now.
I agree. You know, that's one thing that eventually I'd love to talk more about is how we manage risk in the IT operation. But I personally have thought for a long time that companies really are probably going to have to go down this route. They're going to have to transfer this risk like they do with other liabilities that are just too expensive, because this is just an extremely difficult problem to solve. And, you know, much like we don't build buildings that are fireproof, we build them fire resistant and we minimize the chances and then we transfer the risk in terms of catastrophic loss. I'm thinking something similar will eventually, you know, be driven by these companies, you know, because it's not that it's a losing battle, but there is no perfect solution. And I think the deeper we get into, you know, the connection of everything and you know, the internet and the cloud being everywhere, this is just going to get worse and worse. And I don't see that slowing down unless we slow the pace of innovation. And I don't see that happening. So they're going to have to do something. There's too many companies getting hit too hard. And so I think this is going to be the natural solution, because all the typical mindset of execs is, how do I insure against it?
Yep, absolutely. Well, we'll have to put that down on a list of future topics to talk about. So, all right, the last story we have is a Dutch DNS. Actually, it's the the .nl domain registrar got compromised. And more specifically, one of the registrars that's delegated from .nl had their account compromised. And this registrar's name was... I don't remember. Anyway, their account was compromised, and the attackers logged in and changed the DNS servers of this this registrar. So every one of the thousands of domains that this registrar managed pointed to an attacker-controlled DNS server, which redirected anybody visiting those to a site that showed under construction. I'm envisioning a 1995, guy with a shovel deal. But it had an iframe that redirected to a black hole exploit page.
So first thing, just a little clue, guys. Next time, don't do an under construction page. Put up pictures of kittens, and people start sending it around. It'll get more people to your site.
I don't know what to say.
It's kittens, man.
It's brilliant. Don't ever go to the dark side.
You know, and before we continue, I do want to propose one other thing for the podcast going forward. I think we need a jar. And I think anytime either of us says the word cyber, we have to put a dollar in the jar. And
so the only retort I'll have is unless it's in the title. Otherwise,
I'm
with you.
What if it's in the body of the story?
Oh man!
All right. Well,
we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
We're gonna have to come up with a key buzzword bingo that drives everybody crazy.
By the way,
cyber.
The company name was Digitalis.
Wasn't he one of the Greek gods? I don't know. Anyway, carry on.
Greek gods of iPads. I don't know.
Anyway. All right, so redirect DNS, iframe, drop an exploit.
Black hole, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, the reason I wanted to talk about this is that, you know, again, especially in this case, if you think about it, right, you are a company that has a really strict web filtering policy, right? This exploit sailed right through.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know... So point being, there are, again, nothing is perfect, right? So here is an example of an attack that totally bypassed your web filter.
Well, and this was also a really, really mild way you could have used this, right? If I can own your DNS and I can redirect, let's say, I don't know, just for kicks, we'll pick on Amazon. Let's say I can own Amazon's, you know, DNS. And I redirect to my exact copy of Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
And when you go to log in, oh, look, I have your credentials or your bank or whatever it is. If you can own DNS and you trust DNS and it gets owned and people start messing with DNS records, it can be really, really, really nasty. And that's one thing I don't know that a lot of people think about. And, you know, the other thing I thought was interesting about this is, you know, DNS records have this time to live concept, which means how long the other DNS servers in the world that look this up cache that information without looking it up again. And you can set that anywhere from, you know, seconds to days. And the bad guys, I think, we're not sure who did, but somebody set the time to live on these for 24 hours. So even once it was found and fixed, there were DNS servers out in the world still serving up the bad IP addresses for up to 24 hours after this occurred, absolutely, which is just gnarly. You know, and the only way you can fix that is to go bounce all those DNS servers, not bounce them, but, you know, manually touch them and force them to reload that zone file. And that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and they're not under the control of any central group. I mean, those DNS servers are just everywhere.
So, you know, I think people have to take their DNS security seriously, and especially when you're doing, you know, centralized DNS off of, you know, Network Solutions or GoDaddy or whatever. If you're managing zone files out there and it's critical stuff, you know, you might want to think pretty heavily about how you're securing that and protecting that, because, you know, we're not exactly sure how they got this, you know, from the article I read, but it sounds like the bad guys just happened to get a password to log into the admin site for this particular customer, And so they had, you know, just logged in and started messing with DNS records. Yeah. And pretty big.
It makes me wonder if we're going to hear, you know, about other things that were done, you know, in the future. You know, I think what they did was a very simple thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you just point everybody to one domain.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly there's a lot of other opportunities to do more damage. Although I have to say, you know, I was really surprised at the amount of money you can be made, you can make on pay per install, right? So, you know, if Black Hole, I think, is between 9 and 14% effective, depending on when you ask and who you ask. You know, if you're pointing thousands and thousands of people at this site, you could potentially make some serious money.
Is that a business proposal?
Well, we'll talk later.
All right, fair enough. You know, the other thing that people might be thinking about, well, what about DNSSEC? Well, that doesn't help you at all here because everything was trusted. The original zone files were what was modified, and so the entire path down was completely trusted. It's not like somebody was poisoning DNS. They were attacking it at the root. So, you know, one thing businesses may do if they're concerned about this is find ways to monitor what is coming back. You know, they should know the IP addresses of their web farms. And there are ways to set up monitoring to make sure that those don't change and alert you that when they do, that may not, you know, there's two ways to fight this, right? Make sure it doesn't happen. And then two, find out about it as quickly as you possibly can. So, you know, think about something like this. What happens if someone hijacked your DNS and changed your zone files? How would you know? How quickly would you know? Especially if you're sitting inside your organization when you've got internal DNS servers that are resolving it, right? So you need to be out on the internet somewhere monitoring this stuff.
Exactly. So what about from the perspective of the unwitting person who's not hosting a site? Let's say you're just an organization who wants to visit one of these sites. You know, there's not a lot you can do. You don't control anything. It's very difficult to recognize that, you know, the DNS of some popular site that your employees visit was just changed. You know, the only thing you really have is potentially the opportunity to recognize that somebody's stuffing Black Hole exploits down on your people.
Which I think I saw that film in the '80s. But it was bad. Sorry, that was a terrible joke. I apologize.
It was the '70s, by the way.
Yeah, that joke sounded better in my head. You know, it goes back to maybe just assuming all sites are hostile. And just trying to harden whatever your browsing platform is as best you can. But, you know, mom and pops aren't going to do that. They're just going to be screwed. And it sucks. But that's where the bad guys are at and, you know, where we're at right now. And, you know, I think this was going after Java and PDF again and again and again. How often have we heard that? Because they're both just so easy to attack and they're not patched. And, you know, I'd be curious if, you know, how many of these folks that got hit with this were hit because of unpatched Java or unpatched PDF. And, you know, we know it. We live and breathe it. We patch this every day. But the reality is most people just, it's not their gig. So, but, you know, to answer the question, what else can you do is just assume all sites are hostile and try to harden your browsing platform as best you can, you know, with patches and tools and techniques and, you know, best of luck. Yeah. Wow, that was depressing. I'm sorry.
Well,
next week, unicorns and rainbows.
So it's been something I've been struggling with. You know, I think a lot about this for my organization and just generally, you know, this kind of goes back to, again, what you said, right? You have to assume it's all hostile. And so you really have to understand what you have going on in your organization and figuring out, hey, should the guy who's, you know, using, guy or girl, who's accessing my bank account to handle funds, be able to, you know, surf the internet at large from that same computer?
Well, and this is where we're getting into some interesting techniques like disposable workstations. Yes. And, you know, virtual desktop environments and, you know, things that we can build up for critical, sensitive information and then toss it immediately. if you know, with the assumption, again, we're kind of now going to the assumption is we can't stop the bad guys. How do we mitigate and limit them, right? If there's no way to stop them, how do we deal with it? And how do we put bars on the window? Because people are going to try to get in anyway. So there are some techniques. That's one thing, you know, we haven't talked a lot about technology or vendors or techniques, but, you know, if you're in an organization, there's certainly lots of things you can do on the network environment for your non-roaming users to try to scrub this stuff before it comes down. There's a lot of vendors out there that have that technology, but, you know, it's definitely tough, too, at the endpoint because they're just so volatile. It's so difficult. You know, I'm actually starting to become a fan of things like whitelisting technologies at the endpoint and virtual desktops at the endpoint for really critical boxes, just because I just don't see the other tools really doing it. Yeah. And so I've almost gotten to the assumption of the bad guys are going to get in. So let's see how we can limit them as best we can.
Right. Right. You have to plan for your protections to fail. There's just too many ways for these guys to get in.
It's true.
So
it's true.
Anyway, that was a happy, happy story. So that is all the stories for tonight, and hopefully you find the new format interesting and maybe more engaging than what has been basically a monologue of me just droning on previously. So with that, we're going to call it a week, and you can, again, find the podcast on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org, on Twitter at DefensiveSec. You can find me at MaliciousLink. You can find Lurg at?
At Lurg, L-E-R-G.
There you go. And with that, anything you want to say?
No, I just appreciate being here, and you know, I look forward to future installments with you.
Excellent. It was great having you here. Enjoyed talking to you as always. We'll talk to you all again next week. Take care. Bye.